And now for reading and writing and radio.
Voice belongs to boy soprano Reinhold Zott, who was about 9 years old to judge by his picture on the album. But you can be a singer too, and a bright-eyed writer.
WSSR Radio at Sangamon State University presents Reading and Writing and Radio, a program about creative writing. Your host is Jacqueline Jackson, children's author and professor of literature at Sangamon State University.
William Maine is one of my favorite authors, and of his books, my favorite is A Swarm in May. It's about John Owen, 8 or 9 years old, who is a singing boy, a chorister, a boy soprano in a British church, the famous Canterbury Cathedral, although the book never names it, and who works hard to get himself out of a solo singing job that he is supposed to do, and then, realizing later that he really wants to do it, he works even harder to get the job back for himself. That's only a tiny bit of the plot. The book is a strange combination of a long-ago mystery having to do with the cathedral and, of all things, bees, beeswax, and making candles, a great deal about music, singing, cathedrals, cathedral services, cathedral customs, and even more about life in a boarding school, that school being the Boys' Cathedral Choir School. Maine's descriptions are always vivid. Listen to an omelet. You think you can't hear an omelet? Well, maybe you can hear this one. Mr. Argent, the headmaster, is making an omelet. He tipped the basin of beaten egg into the smoking frying pan. The yellow mixture went in with a great sizzle, swirling round on the hot fat in great peninsular continents until it met itself and joined up into a disk and began to blow blisters. "It looks like the prehistoric moon, sir," said Owen. "That was all round and all volcanoes." "Just as round, but not so edible as choir school omelet," said Mr. Ardent. He pulled in the hem of the omelet and let the liquid center flow to the edges. Then he folded the whole thing in two, sliced it in three, and scooped one piece onto each plate. Here is a description of the cathedral at night. John Owen is coming back from holidays. His train is late, and so it is dark when he is let in through the gate. In front of Owen now, there was the cathedral, gray and soft in starry light. It stood in grass like a ship anchored in a green swell. The uneven lawns swept away from the walls in bow waves and eddies, flurries and wakes. Yet nothing moved, and across the tides of grass was stretched in two or three places a gangplank of a door to a path. No, that's of a path to a door. Above the door there would be a window 80 times its size, so that the people in and out of the door looked like ants at the entrance to their own tiny terraces. Now the building was dark and empty. The windows were as solid as the walls, and the most solid parts of the whole were the shadows between the buttresses and behind the outrigged chapels. High above the shadowed hull rose the tower like a mast full of sail, and the lights from the town came over the houses and lit up the traced arches, the channeled corners, and the four golden wind flags on the turrets above the corners. Here let me pause to say that there is a fine book, a large-sized informational picture book by David Macaulay. It's in Lincoln Library and certainly elsewhere. It's called Cathedral, which shows pictures and diagrams of all parts of a cathedral, and it goes into the history of cathedrals, too. Macaulay has another one called Castle. All cathedrals and castles aren't alike, of course, but they do follow a general pattern. We have cathedrals in this country, and also a castle or two, but with a couple of exceptions, the cathedrals aren't the huge ships at sea that many of the European cathedrals are, and none of them are the staggering engineering wonders without steel and cranes that were built by hand in the Middle Ages. Last June, a class of us went to England. Some of your teachers went, and we visited quite a few cathedrals and marveled at Westminster Abbey, where the kings and queens of England are crowned, Winchester, where once upon a time they were crowned, St. Paul's, Gloucester, Wells, Salisbury. We had all read A Swarm in May, and while we didn't get to Canterbury, all the cathedrals reminded us of John Owen as his adventures up and down and in and out and all around the nooks and crannies of an ancient cathedral. We even sat up next to the choir at a service in Christ Church Cathedral, Oxford, but I had goofed, and all the choir boys were home on vacation. It was a volunteer choir of church members, men and women, and they sang beautifully, and it was very enjoyable nevertheless. But we did miss seeing and hearing the boys. Choirs in most of these cathedrals are made up of males. There used to be a rule in the medieval church against women participating in the services, and therefore there weren't any women allowed in the choirs. I know that that's unfair, and today only a few churches don't allow women to participate. Even those that won't have women ministers or priests usually have women in the choirs. But the tradition of the male choir has held in most of these English cathedrals. So what do they do about the part of the music that goes up high? Well, you heard it in our opener. They use boy sopranos like Reinhold Zott, boy altos, and then the men sing the lower parts, the tenor and the bass. Now, a boy can be a soprano only until he's 13 or so. His voice changes as he matures into a man. It becomes deeper. Sometimes this is as early as 12 or as late as 14 or even 15. So there's a limited time that a boy can be in the choir singing the high parts. If he doesn't join the choir till he's 11, he hardly has time to be there at all. So the choirs try to get choir boys as young as they can, 7 or 8 years old. Then they can be choir members for 5, 6, 7 years, and all the time and the money that is spent on them is a good investment both for the cathedral and the boys. I heard the choir director of St. Paul's, London, a man named Barry Rose, talking over public radio in our country a number of years ago at the intermission of a concert that the choir was singing in St. Paul, Minnesota, and the interviewer asked how choir boys were chosen. I have never forgotten Barry Rose's answer. It's a good thing for a boy to be chosen as a choir boy, for he will get a first-rate school education, plus a musical education, not only in singing, but he'll have music lessons in piano or organ or violin, and classes in theory, harmony, counterpoint, and all of this is absolutely free. So small boys and their parents all over the British Isles are eager to come for auditions. The first requirement, naturally, is that the boy must have a beautiful singing voice, clear and pure and high. If he hasn't that, he might as well not have come. The second requirement, after he's passed the first, is that he have some musicianship, some musical ability, or potential for musical ability. You might have a beautiful voice, but not enough musical smarts to do much with it beyond singing Happy Birthday. So a boy is tested for how true his ear is. Does he have a good sense of pitch, of rhythm, of phrasing? Can he read music, or will he be able to learn readily to read music? Things like that. If he passes the beautiful voice and the musicianship hurdles, the third requirement is, can he cut the mustard when it comes to regular schoolwork? For a chorister has a job. He needs to put in time on being a chorister, and he must be able to keep up with regular schoolwork without a great struggle. If he proves acceptable in these three areas, voice, musicianship, and scholarship, and maybe Barry Rose mentioned one more area, the physical one, because a boy would have to be in reasonable physical shape, even pretty good physical shape, to stand the rigors of the demanding life of being a chorister. If he passes all these tests, then, says Barry Rose, there's one more test that he, Barry Rose, uses before he makes his final selection of the boys to be in the choir. And what is that? Asked the interviewer. Barry Rose said, bright eyes. I knew immediately what he meant, for that's what I look for, too, in my students, in my friends, in the kids I know. Bright eyes means engagement, interestedness. A bright-eyed kid is one who sits up and takes notice, who isn't bored, who's eager, who is, in the British term, keen. We sometimes say bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, and what we see is the alert, quick actions of a squirrel, how they dart, how they know what's going on above and below them and all around them and are constantly reacting as well as leading the action. When I'm being an author, talk to kids at a book fair or in a classroom or in an auditorium, I find that it's the bright eyes that I'm talking to, where there is contact, where there's a kind of electric communication going on between us. The vacant looks, the yawns, the staring out of windows, the dull eyes, those are the kids who aren't engaged, aren't meshed, aren't in gear, at least with me. And it's a challenge, of course, to see if I can get any of those dull eyes to brighten, to come to life. For most kids will get bright eyes about something. But Barry Rose was meaning, if he had to choose between two equally qualified boys, that he'd go for the one whose eyes were already bright, whose body was alert and vibrant, who was used to seeing the world as a lively and interesting place, a curious place that he wanted to be part of, a kid who didn't need to be coaxed but was jumping into living like jumping off the high dive and then splashing and learning to swim. I thought of calling today's program Bright Eyes, and that's the topic that I suggest for writing on. The book that I recommend reading is William Maine's A Swarm in May. And the music that I recommend you're listening to is Boy Sopranos, and you can find those on a number of different records. But your writing? Think about your own eyes. When are they sometimes or often dull and glazed over? What turns them bright? What makes you come alive, have bright eyes? What are you so keen about that when you are pursuing that, you are in gear, you are engaged with life? Your eyes are bright. Write and tell me about it.
WSSR Radio has presented Reading and Writing and Radio. Send your writings to Jacqueline Jackson, Sangamon State University, Springfield, Illinois, 62708.